Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 232 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore. Welcome to the regular season. The Mets are 1-1. Opening day was great. Last night was not so great, but that's okay because we have a great jam-packed podcast for you. But I'm not going to bury the lead. Chris talked to Noah Syndergaard. Here it is.
All right, joining us this week on Amazing Avenue Audio is Mets pitcher Noah Syndergaard. Noah, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you're here today for Sports Crate, the exclusive licensed subscription box of Major League Baseball. What is that?
It's a subscription-based plan that you can get a crate with some pretty cool fan experiences in it. It's delivered right to your door. I just think it's awesome. It's a great way to kind of get back to the fans and really show them how much we appreciate them. It's got all kinds of cool gear. I know this month's going to feature an action figure that looks like me, and I'm actually playing with it right now, and it's pretty sweet looking.
Nice.
For myself.
Yeah, that I feel like there's a good collection of stuff going between the gnome last year, the promos you have coming up this year with the Mets. In terms of this,
pretty easy to get a hold of. You just go to sportscrate.com and go from there.
All right. So you are coming off a very successful opening day start. It's Wednesday morning now as we record this. Are you prepared to see Bartolo Colon pitching in a Braves uniform tonight?
I think it's going to sting a little bit, it was awesome seeing him out there on the field. It's just a little different seeing him in a Braves uniform. You know, I think he was really good for the Mets and really good for their fan base, and he'll be dearly missed.
Yeah. What would you say in the time that he was your teammate was the biggest takeaway that you got from spending time with him in the rotation, you know, in the clubhouse, just all
from his jolly old self, you can take every 5 days, he's going to go out there and have the time of his life. You know, he's 43 years old, but he's still a kid out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no, he's been a pleasure to watch. And I think, you know, one thing that's very obvious is that you've been all about the player-fan relationship. So I think one thing where fans can relate to you the best is that we're all big Bartolo fans. What is it for you that you get out of that relationship with fans? Because on this end, it's, you know, somebody with your level of talent who shows that openness with fans, I think, becomes someone who's very, very easy to root for. What do you take out of that relationship?
I think we're playing in the greatest city with the greatest fan base. And, you know, it's just a long, grueling season, and just being able to go out there when we have home games at Citi Field and feel the electricity and the atmosphere from the fans is second to none in my mind.
So you have said at points that, despite your stature, both physically and within the game, that, you know, inside you're still a nerd. What would you say is the nerdiest thing that you are doing these days?
I think the whole Marvel coming out with a little bobblehead. I thought that was pretty cool and nerdy because I'm a big superhero fan. I'm a big, huge Game of Thrones fan. I recently went to Spain and did a little cameo appearance with them. I think that's about it.
Yeah. Yeah, we're looking forward to that. It'll be right in the middle of the baseball season, too, which is unique timing for Game of Thrones, but it'll be fun. You played a Wildling, correct?
I started already.
Oh, what was that?
I said I wish it would hurry up and start already.
Oh, yeah. you and me both. The Marvel movies, what's your favorite other than, I guess let's rule out both Thor movies because that might be, you know, unfair competition. Any of the other ones stand out?
I'm a big fan of The Incredible Hulk, Iron Man.
All right. So a couple more things baseball-wise. Dan Worthen's gotten a lot of attention. Obviously, he's been working with several very talented pitchers, but it seems like a really good relationship. What is the biggest thing that you get from working with him?
He just makes things easy to absorb and learn. He makes coming to the ballpark fun each and every day. He's just a great guy on and off the field. I couldn't be more thankful to be able to work with him. And I think he's doing a lot of great things with the young starting pitching staff that we have.
Yeah, and you guys obviously were part of Major League Baseball's ads coming into the season with the dinner scene. You know, how much time do you guys spend as a rotation together, you know, whether it be between games when the four guys who aren't starting that day or away from the ballpark? What's that group like?
You know, like the starting crew will go out there probably about 15, 20 minutes before each game and watch the starting pitcher for that day warm up. And I think it's just something that's really cool because it kind of just shows that the other starting pitchers that aren't pitching that day are kind of just back behind you, supporting you. I think it's cool to be a part of because we're kind of just a brotherhood within the team.
Yeah. Has anyone thrown your lunch away recently?
No. not in quite some time.
All right. I think that was one of the lunch police tweet was maybe one of the first moments of like, oh, this guy is not just another player on social media. He gets it. And it's been an enjoyable ride since then. In terms of, obviously, you know, the expectations are high this season. You had that first good start. You know, what kind of things do you set for yourself maybe as sort of checkpoints along the way in terms of getting a successful season under your belt, both for yourself and for the team?
I think the number one priority right now is just being able to stay healthy, stay on the field. Can't really compete when I'm hurt and sitting on the bench. So I think that's a big key and a big team goal for all of us, just to go out there and stay healthy. Nothing really too specific as far as goals go. I'm just really more focused on the process and not necessarily the finish line.
Yeah. In terms of the other things that are coming up, do they make a Noah Syndergaard hair hat that will actually fit Noah Syndergaard? I'm curious if you've gotten to check one out yet.
I don't think I've tried one on, but I do have a big noggin with a lot of hair. There was actually a funny video during spring training that they put a Syndergaard jersey on Jerry Blevins and then put the wig on him, and it was like a camera angle coming from behind him, and then he turned around, and it was just funny, especially because it's Jerry Blevins wearing a wig.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a good one. It was pretty great when he went blonde at the end of last season, too. He sort of seems like, I guess, if you have the current claim to funniest Mets starting pitcher, he seems like he is your counterpart in the bullpen.
Say that one more time?
Oh, if you have the claim now to funniest Mets starting pitcher, he seems like your counterpart in that regard in the bullpen.
Yeah, he's a pretty funny guy. I'd say Addison Reed's up there as well.
Oh, all right. That one's surprising. I love his work as a pitcher, just didn't know that at all. So, all right, last thing before we go. Do you ever load up the Pedro Martinez Vine in which he says Thor on MLB Network? Because I think it's one of the probably better Vines in the history of that now deceased site.
The Vine of Pedro saying Thor for the World Series, is that what you said?
Yeah, when it did the Thor.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. Just coming from a great pitcher like Pedro, definitely makes me feel good inside.
Yeah. All right, Noah, well, thanks again for coming on. Good luck this season. We're certainly rooting for you here, and look forward to seeing what you can accomplish.
I appreciate that.
Isn't that pretty cool? I thought you guys would enjoy that. We are going to be back with Chris in a little while, but first, I was joined by Greg Karam and Steve Saipa, two of our minor league experts, and I was joined briefly, you can't hear it, by Lucas Vlahos, who was another one of our minor league experts, and, well, you'll hear what happened. Well, folks, we are here with our minor league preview for the 2017 season. Say hello to the Amazon Avenue minor league guys. We got Greg Karam, Steve Saipa, and Lucas Vlahos calling in from what sounds like the world's oldest cell phone, but I'm sure it's not. It's just the technology we've been challenged with for tonight. But, gentlemen, before we get started too deep, why don't each of you just give us kind of a one- or two-sentence description of where you feel the Mets farm system is this year? Steve, we'll start with you.
Thin in pitching, deep in middle infield prospects.
Okay, Greg, what about you?
Well, I wrote like a series, like I guess it feels like a long time ago, back in the fall, and I kind of felt like the system was in a good position in that it had distributed talent through like near to the majors, far from the majors, kind of medium term from the majors. And I actually sounded like when the national list came out, that I was actually a little low. Like people were more bullish on the Mets system than I even thought they were going to be. Particularly, I think Keith Ball was a little higher than on them than most other people. So I feel very good about the system. I'm happy that other people feel even better about the system than I do.
In a bit of breaking news here, our system is not as deep as we thought it was because we've lost Lucas. And so we're just going to move on with just the three of us for the rest of this conversation, unfortunately. Sorry, Lucas. You were here for 10 seconds. It was memorable. Stay tuned for the end of the episode, folks. I will include a great bit of audio for your listening pleasure. So if that's not reason to stay tuned to the end, I don't know what is. So, all right, let's sort of jump right in here. Steve, you mentioned that you think that the team is very, very deep in middle infield prospects. Is there one aside from Ahmed Rosario, who everybody knows is the number one overall prospect for the Mets, pretty much consensus? Is there any other middle infield prospect you want to specifically highlight tonight?
Well, we can talk about one of the guys that I'm not as high on as everybody else. And that is going to be Andrés Giménez. And it's not that I don't think that he's going to be good, but I just can't justify getting so hyped on a kid that really only has DSL experience, no matter how highly thought of they are by scouts and everybody. I mean, look at Vicente Lupo as the cautionary tale. Not that Giménez is Lupo, but, you know, everyone was so high on Lupo, and he turned out to be a fizzle. So,
see, that's interesting because I would push back on that only because we haven't really had the opportunity to lay eyes on this guy. And what we have to do, I mean, at least from my perspective, is kind of lean on the people who have reports on these guys. And the people who I trust who have reports on these guys are, well, actually, the only person I trust who has reports on these guys is like Ben Badler from Baseball America, who has contacts down in the DSL. And he's raving about Giménez, you know. So, like, when I hear that from him, I kind of lean heavily on that. And then you back it up with some good stats, and you couple that together, and I get a little excited. So I think that was the missing part from the Vicente Lupo part, was that like there were just no reports that kind of supported that.
Right. I'm not saying that Giménez, you know, he's getting rave reviews, and people are saying, you know, people who know are saying that he has great, you know, talent and everything, but it just, he's so far, he doesn't have stateside experience, and, you know, I can't personally justify ranking him, like, you know, fourth on the prospect list or something like that, just
fair
based
enough
on reports and, you know, good DSL stats.
Yeah, I think he's more a guy, like, forget rankings, just, he's a guy that within the system I'm excited about because there's so much potential there, and he's one of the guys I'm most looking forward to seeing how they progress this year.
That I agree with you.
Yeah.
I guess we sort of buried the lead by not talking about Rosario at all. So let's just circle back on there for 1 second. I know that for the average fan like myself who pays attention to minor league stats but is nowhere near a minor league expert, Rosario seems like a dream come true. He seems like a really, really complete prospect who's going to be outstanding on both sides of the ball. Why don't I know, Greg, you're particularly high on Rosario. Can you give me one sort of maybe one aspect of his game that gives you a lot of confidence? And then, Steve, do you want to play devil's advocate and give us one aspect of his game that maybe should give us a little bit of pause?
I'll try, but he's a good player.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can just start and say the thing that I like the best about Rosario is his bat speed and his ability to just get around on anything. You can't bust him in because he's going to be able to turn on it. And he's just got great bat to ball with the bat. So I just, that's probably the thing I like most. I mean, I like his defense too, but you know, if I had to pick one, I'm going to go with the bat speed.
The only thing I could say that's not bad, it's not even bad about him, but I mean, you know, he's not going to be a major power threat, and that's okay, you know, given everything else that he brings to the table. But I don't know, that's the biggest knock in his game, I guess. Maybe he'll be limited to, you know, 10 home runs, which is fine for a shortstop, but...
Yeah, what? I mean, if I had to pick a negative for him, I would say maybe... I mean, he's even gotten better at this last year, but like he does like to swing. And part of the strength of this game is that he's able to make contact on a lot of things. So like if that discipline doesn't hold up in the majors and like he's swinging and missing because the velocity is good, the you know, breaking balls are good, like that's a thing I could see. I could see him having a lot of swing and miss, maybe. But even that's pushing it for me.
Yeah, his swing is a little weird. And, you know, maybe pitchers will be able to exploit the way that he holds the bat, but, eh. Mm.
Thanks, Keith. if you guys had to put a ballpark, let's take over under with the All-Star break as the middle ground here. Do you think we see Rosario before the All-Star break or after the All-Star break?
I would say before, even though he's kind of down in the depth chart, I mean, you think about if Cabrera goes down, you can ship Reyes over, you can move Flores to third. Like, there's options as far as shortstop goes. But you'd be hard-pressed for me. It'd be hard-pressed to not bring him up if one of the middle infielders went down for me, just because he's got such immense talent and I think he's ready.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really see what – he stands to gain by spending a lot of time in AAA. So I think if the opportunity arises at the major league level where they need a guy to play shortstop for, you know, a couple of weeks, whatever it may be, then I feel like they'll pull the trigger and just bring him up.
Yeah, I feel like the 10-day DL is going to make this an interesting year for watching how rosters are managed. But I think if someone, you know, if Asdrubal Cabrera is out for 3 to 4 weeks, to me it makes sense to bring up Rosario at that point, as opposed to just for a 10-day DL stint. So I think that I'm hoping it's after the All-Star break, because that means that the team has remained relatively healthy, but I wouldn't be surprised if we see him before the All-Star break.
Especially with this team.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I thoroughly was tickled by how the Citi Field faithful knows that Ray Ramirez is somehow to blame, because during the introductions yesterday, he got a healthy, healthy set of boos there.
He's got something on the Wilpons. I mean, it's just the only way that he's still around. But that's a story for another day.
He and Dan Worthen like walked in on something they really shouldn't have seen, and the two of them will be employees for life. Not that Worthen doesn't deserve it, but you know,
yeah,
you understand. And a prospect that got a lot of attention during spring training, partially due to the World Baseball Classic, is somebody who Steve is not very high on, and that's Philip Evans. So, Steve, what is it about Evans that doesn't work for you?
It's just hard to get excited about Evans when his one good season in the last couple of years came with a 384 BABIP, which is about 100 points higher than anything else that he's ever done. He did retool his approach and his swing a little bit, so it's possible that maybe he will be able to post, you know, higher BABIPs, which then will allow him to have, you know, higher batting average and higher on-base percentage in the future. But, you know, until he does that, it's just, I'm going to take that one good season here with a grain of salt.
Greg, do you similarly feel that we should throw some fire on this excitement, or are you buying into Evans as a potential real prospect?
I think he's a decent prospect. I think that he's he can play around the infield, and he's got a short, quick bat. And if you have that, you saw it with TJ Rivera last year. You can make some contact. You can have some value as a guy off the bench. So, I mean, I'm not looking at Evans as a guy who can play every day, but he could potentially come off the bench for me in a year or two. And I think he's a decent prospect.
It's funny, every now and then during spring training, you'll see the broadcast booth latch onto somebody for whatever reason. And early in the spring, it was Evans that they were really, really high on. And, you would think that it was the second coming of David Wright, the way they were talking about him. But I think for a lot of fans, it's just I think any third base prospect is going to have a long way to go before the fans are ready to truly embrace him. And I think with a guy who, as you said, Steve, has had very, very BABIP-dependent best season, it's going to take a long time for people to possibly accept him as the real deal. I think even more so because he does play third base. And that's not really fair, but that's just the way it is. All right, let's see. There's a lot of interesting, just to pull back the curtain a little bit, I asked the guys to each put together some players they were high on, some players they were low on. And there's some interesting, synergy here. Both of you guys are low on Gavin Cecchini and Wilmer Becerra. Two names that I think the casual Mets fan knows pretty well. So let's start with Cecchini. What do you guys see as the best case scenario for Cecchini right now?
Oh, that's easy. I mean, like, if he's able to throw the ball from second base to first base, he could actually be a major league regular. Like, I think the bat is that good in terms of bat to ball and making contact. And he doesn't strike out that much, and he knows how to take a base. But the only problem with him is that, I mean, in the field, he's not very good with the glove either. But the arm is just—it's really just a scatter shot. I mean, it just goes—he just doesn't have the arm for short. And I'm not sure if he has the arm for second. So if he's able to throw the ball accurately from second base to first base, then the outlook is actually pretty good.
Steve, anything to add to that or no?
Yeah, I mean they're officially moving him to second base this season. I mean, it should have been done a season or two ago, but whatever. Better late than never. But I mean, shifting him over a little bit isn't necessarily going to help the issue. He's getting an extra, 10, 20 feet, whatever it is. But if he's still going to have issues there, then his one plus, the bat, it's not enough to negate just that really, really terrible defense.
It's amazing to me how bad his arm sounds from reading things, but I haven't seen it enough to make my own opinion here. Would it be like considerably worse than a bad major league arm?
Yeah, no, it's not a good major league arm. Like it's a bad major league arm. So the context here is that a couple of years ago, I liked Cecchini, and then going into, I think, the 2016 season, I had ranked him very highly. And then I kind of dove into his previous season and was like, watched a lot of games. And I wanted to like him. But, I mean, it was just like, it's one mistake after another. It's like he has bad mechanics with his feet. He has a bad glove, which forces him to rush his throws. And his throws are just, even when he's set properly, it's all over the place. And he just doesn't have the strength behind it to kind of make up for that. And it's just really bad. You don't see it. You don't see it that much in the majors because the guys who make it to the majors, they can throw and they can play. I mean, you don't get to see these guys who are just not there, just down the fringes, just below. You don't get to see them that much. And that is where Cecchini is.
What about Wilmer Becerra? For fans that maybe recognize the name but can't place it, he was the sort of thrown-in final prospect in the Noah Syndergaard, Travis d'Arnaud, R.A. Dickey trade. Are people unfairly high on him, or do you guys just feel that he's not worth discussion at all?
I mean, he's definitely worth discussion, but just his power outage from last season is very worrisome. I mean, he's a right fielder. You know, he has all the tools to be a right fielder, so he should be a right fielder. And one of the things that right fielders need is power. And Becerra just hasn't, he has shown that in the past, and it has just disappeared. And yeah, he had shoulder surgery last year in July, which ended his season. And you could chalk the lack of power to that injury if you want. But what makes it worrisome for me is that the lack of power goes back further than just, you know, that labrum injury in 2016. He slugged 480 and he hit 8 home runs in the first half of 2015. And then then in the second half, he slugged 355 with 1 home run. And, you know, they kind of tinkered around with his swing a little bit. So it could just be that, you know, the changes to his batting stance and his swing are what caused the lack of power.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what to make of Becerra. I mean, like, he's mostly, I feel, like, physical specimen, and people are very wrapped up in how he looks physically and, like, the potential. But I just, the lack of power. I mean, I could be totally wrong. I admit I probably haven't seen as much of Becerra as I probably should have, but I'm just not that excited about the profile based on what I've read, based on what I've seen, and based on the shoulder and the lack of power. It's just, I'm prepared to be wrong on this, but for right now, I'm not very excited about it.
All right, here comes some interesting stuff. So, Greg really likes Ricky Knapp.
He's a good guy.
And, Steve, do you have much to say about Ricky Knapp?
I'm a fan of his.
This is where Lucas would have been really interested.
I know. Yeah. I know.
I mean, 2015, I think it was, they kind of converted him to being a starting pitcher, just not bouncing up and down bullpen to rotation. They just let him sit in the bullpen. He kind of took off in the rotation. And, you know, last season he had an okay season, and he's just kind of has a whole assortment of junk.
Junk.
Hey, you heard the broadcast yesterday. You can't call it junk.
The
kitchen
so,
sink.
Yeah.
here's my pitch on Ricky Knapp. Is that basically, guys, he's got four pitches, right? He's got fastball, slider, changeup, curveball. Okay, and he can throw them all with command, and that's not a small thing. I mean, he's able to throw him to either side of the plate. He can throw it at any count. I mean, the slider's farther behind the change in the curve than anything else. And so that's going to have some work, but we have an organization that knows how to teach a slider. So I feel pretty good about that. And I mean, the case against him is more about like velocity. Obviously, I mean, I get that he's 88 to 92. He's only 6'1". You know, there's not maybe that much left in the frame. My counterpoint to that would be that he's got a very low effort delivery. I think he's got a little bit more to offer in the velocity department. And so when you add it all up, so you got a guy who has three secondaries. He's got the fastball, can command it. You know, it's a very, for me, a very exciting profile. And when you add into that the fact that I think he's got a little bit more velocity in there, that's how I get excited about him. So if I was going to make a bold prediction this year, I would say that Ricky Knapp's going to be touching 94, 95 in Las Vegas, and he's going to come up later in the year, and he's going to make some starts for the big league team and not be a disaster. That's my bold prediction for this year.
That is pretty bold.
Hey, given the health of this rotation, it's not that far off.
I mean, I don't doubt that he'll make some starts. I just don't know if he won't be an abject disaster. But I mean, then again, I mean, his stuff isn't, you know, he gets, you know, from the, you know, quote unquote scouting industry, whatever, you know, he gets some flack because he doesn't really have any one standout pitch. You know, he just kind of has a lot of average stuff, but it's not like players that are just solid all around don't have success. You know, you don't need to have one super plus pitch or a bunch of super plus pitches, whatever. As long as you're, you know, a cerebral pitcher, and Knapp is a cerebral pitcher, you can get by. So,
all right. So let's see what else we got here. Okay, here's some fun stuff. Why did you guys talk about Pete Alonso for a second?
Wait, I forget if Steve's high on Pete or not. I don't remember.
I'm a big fan.
Big fan. Okay, well then, why don't you go and then I can counter you.
I mean, the biggest concerns really with him is his swing. You know, he kind of gets it. It's a long swing, but then again, you know, what power hitter doesn't have a long swing? And it's really just kind of inconsistencies in his, you know, upper half and lower half with the swing. But I feel like those are things that can be coached. You know, he's going to start the season in St. Lucie. And, you know, it's not like he's knocking on the door of the MLB a finished product. These are things that could be coached out of him. And really the physical tools are there, you know, and that's the most important thing because you can't teach that.
Fair enough. I mean, he's a big dude. He's very strong. I mean, my concern is the same thing that you just said is, but basically he's got a long swing and he's got a little bit of a hitch like before his swing. So if he's able to iron out those issues, maybe they coach it out of him, then that'd be great. And I would be a little bit more excited about him. However, we're not going to know that for like a very long time now because he's going to be in St. Lucie and no one ever sees St. Lucie. So, you know, we're just going to be scouting the stat line for a little while and we'll just have to see what happens.
All right. Let's see who else we want to talk about here. Here's another nice contrast with you guys. Ali Sanchez.
Oh yeah, well I'm not high on him, but
oh I know.
but again it's like a Becerra thing. Like I haven't seen Sanchez, and so therefore my opinion is not really that informed, except for the fact that he hasn't hit, and it goes back to the thing that Steve and I were talking about last fall is that basically like you know how do you project that a guy is going to hit just you know. Just by watching him and seeing him seeing his swing and projecting that out. And so, you know, I would have to probably set eyes on him before I got more comfortable saying that he's going to be able to hit down the road. So I'm a little low on him, but it's not the most informed opinion. So Steve, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I saw him a couple of times last year at Brooklyn. Obviously, you know, he didn't hit very much. But I think that you have to give an asterisk partially because of, you know, he got injured like the second game of the year or whatever. He hurt his hand, so he's dealing with that injury for most of the season. I mean, a couple of at-bats, you know, he made some real solid contact. I think that he could have, you know, line drive power with, you know, a couple of them sneaking over the wall, you know, coming years to come. But ultimately, you know, if he can hit halfway decently, he has a good reputation as a defensive catcher, so, you know, he'll always have that to carry him forward if the bat doesn't really develop much.
All right. Yeah. Let's see who else we want to talk about here. You guys pretty much, we've sort of hit on all the big differences of opinion here. But let's talk about some of the Mets' top prospects for a second. Desmond Lindsay. What can Mets fans expect from that? That's a name you hear a lot about. What can Mets fans expect from Desmond Lindsay?
Well, it depends on if he stays healthy. So, and that's the big question mark with him. And I think, personally, if he stays healthy, he's going to be a top 50 prospect going into next season. Like, that's how high I am on him. Like, he's got plate discipline. He's got power. He's got athleticism to play center field. So if it just comes down to staying healthy and playing a full season and which he hasn't been able to do yet. So that's what I'm hoping for with him.
He reminds me a lot of Beltran. You know, he really is a good athlete.
He stole my heart.
He's a good athlete. You know, he plays a surprisingly good center field for someone that hasn't played center field for very long. He's projected to hit for power, projected to hit for average. He's got a little bit of speed. He does a lot. So, I mean, it would, you know, Beltran is like the 99.99999 percentile outcome. But, you know, outfielder with all those different tools, that's a really good player to have.
Yeah, and we should mention, I guess, that he's going to start in Colombia, which I guess is four levels away from the majors. So he's a bit away, but he's entering into full season ball, and you know, this is where you make your money.
Well, yeah. Not really, because unfortunately, minor leaguers don't make money.
I was going to say, ask Ted Berg about them making money.
Yeah. Well, this is where you make a name for yourself as a prospect.
There we go. And where you sell a ton of jerseys if you're Tim Tebow.
Tim Tebow.
Let's not talk about Tim Tebow.
I think Eric fires us if we don't mention Tim Tebow on the minor league preview. So we have to. We got it in. So okay. Let's move on. Marcos Molina, there's a name that's been floating around prospect circles for a few years now. What do you guys see from him this year?
Steve, take it.
I mean, he's probably going to be starting in St. Lucie this year. They haven't released the rosters, but he hasn't appeared on anyone else's roster yet. So, and, you know, he was in St. Lucie before the Tommy John and everything. But based on the very limited, you know, looks that we got from him in spring training and the Arizona Fall League, the velocity is there. The breaking ball still, you know, looks good. The command hasn't been there, but, you know, he hasn't pitched for, you know, over a year. So he, you know, rightfully has plenty of, you know, he can get the rust off. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. And, I mean, if he has a good season this year, he'll definitely be in the top 10 Mets prospects for next year, possibly even the top 5. I mean, there's going to be a lot of graduations off of that list.
Yeah, I was surprised that he wasn't in Double-A. I mean, I thought they would have kind of wanted him to be closer, but, I mean, we all want the guys to be closer, but I guess it makes sense to take it a little slow coming off of Tommy John and but, I mean, there's a lot to be excited there because the guy was lights out the last time he was healthy. So I'm excited to see what he can do.
Let's see. Tomas Nido. Nido. Okay.
Yeah.
Catching prospect. I think it's funny. A couple of years ago, Mets fans were salivating at the idea of both Travis d'Arnaud and Kevin Pilecki in the system. That salivation has changed a little bit, and so I think Nido has become somebody that a lot of fans are hanging their hopes on. Is that a legitimate person to hang your hopes on, or what? What do you guys think about Nido?
I don't think you should get excited about catching prospects. Just generally. I mean, they take a long time, and you know, they unless they're Gary Sanchez, like they don't bust onto the scene and tear the cover off the ball, and so. I don't know. I like Nido. I think he's got a nice swing. The reports are that he receives the ball well. So there's stuff to be excited about there. It's just that I can't get that excited about Nido when he's probably not going to be able to help the team for a few more years. And there's still some catchers above him who could pan out potentially.
Steve, you were high on him. Tell us why.
I mean, to just be a little down on him for a second, you know, continuing that, he's not a guy that, you know, really I don't think is going to be a difference maker necessarily or, you know, kind of all-star kind of player. But, you know, he could, if everything pans out well, he could be a solid average player. You know, he never really had much success before this season. But the success that he did have this past season, 2016, didn't really come out of the blue. I mean, he calmed his swing down a little bit. He improved his timing on his swing. And that kind of stuff should carry into 2017. Worst case scenario, though, if it doesn't and he regresses a little bit, he'll still have, you know, he has a good reputation as a defensive catcher, so he should still have his defense. And the bar for a passable backup catcher, if that's what his ultimate fate is, you know, isn't very high. And, you know, he's always, reports have always said that he's had good raw power. So if he can, you know, run into the ball every once in a while and send it over the wall, I don't know, it gives him a plus over other backup catchers. So I think that he hopefully does make the major leagues, but the role that he will have, you know, is still kind of blurry at this point.
Agree.
All right, let's talk about everybody's favorite prospect, Dominic Smith.
Finally.
somebody who gets a lot of discussion among Mets fans for reasons that are both good and bad, but on Amazing Avenue tend to be mostly on the negative side. Tell us, why are so many national guys wrong about Dom Smith?
The conversation around Dom Smith is like so, it's so just all over the place because I don't know why, but basically everyone kind of basically says he's going to be a major leaguer. So I don't know necessarily like we're down on him, but like other people are maybe just too high on him for reasons I don't really fully understand. I mean, as a Mets fan, I want him to pan out. I think he's going to hit. I don't know if he's going to be able to hit for power. So therefore I don't know if he's going to be able to stick in the major leagues. And that's kind of my sticking point with him. I mean, at this point, it would kind of tickle me if he was just like a very bland major leaguer, because then everybody would be kind of wrong in some way. But
I think for me is that for whatever reason, and you know, I feel like as I say this, Steve Schreiber's gonna like sit up in his bed in a deep sweat, knowing someone's talking about him, but like. Mets fans don't believe that Lucas Duda is good for whatever reason. Yeah. And he is good. And I think people just want Dom Smith to like validate their opinion of what a first baseman should be, even though Lucas Duda is already doing that. For whatever reason, I guess maybe it's because he's a little bit laconic and he's, you know, he's quiet and he has this bullshit reputation for being streaky. You know, because of all those reasons, everybody just doesn't buy into Duda. But I think if you gave Dom Smith Lucas Duda stats, people would be tripping over their dicks to get him into the lineup even more than they are right now.
I'll tell you what, though, on that. So, first of all, I don't think Dom Smith's ever going to hit 30 home runs in the majors. Like, I really would. That would shock the shit out of me. But the other thing is that the optics on Dom Smith are not good. Okay, and what I mean by that is, like, I mean, I know he came into camp in shape this season, but, like, you know, typically he's overweight. And then the other thing is that he's very lethargic around the field. He's very laid back. He's as we were speaking before the call, he's a California dude. He's very laid back. And so and that rubs people the wrong way because it kind of looks like he doesn't give a shit.
But that's Duda, too.
Right. No, I know, but like this is Duda on steroids. So what I'm saying is that like if Dom Smith doesn't pan out and he doesn't work out, people are going to jump on him really fast. I feel just based on the optics.
Interesting. What do you guys think is the first date we see Dom Smith playing first base for the Mets?
Wow, I really don't know. I feel like it's a situation with Rosario where the only real opportunity to see him is if someone goes down for, you know, a couple of weeks. But I feel like the league team already has, you know, kind of Flores could play first, maybe even better than Smith, you know, who knows. But, you know.
I'd be surprised if you saw him this year.
Yeah, ew.
Because, you know, I mean, Duda is gone next year. So, I mean, the path kind of sets itself and Bruce is gone too. So, like, kind of sets itself up nicely for next year. Maybe. But, yeah, I mean, if Dom Smith is starting this year, I feel like things have gone horribly wrong.
Fair enough. Fair enough. All right, before we get into to your guys, some players that maybe are not quite consensus picks yet, is there anybody else you guys want to really talk about in sort of the upper echelon of Mets prospects?
Well, we should just mention Thomas Zupacki. I don't think he's been mentioned, but this is a guy who we consensusly ranked the third best prospect in the system, and he's lefty, he's got a fastball that goes into the upper 90s, so it's a guy who's we should all be very excited about, and he's going to start the year in St. Lucie, so just got to throw his name out there because he could be the next wave.
Steve, anybody else?
I'll add another pitcher who's in a wave even further than Zupacki, in Cameron Plank. I was when the Mets signed him, when the Mets drafted him, I found him kind of intriguing. I thought that, you know, as a mid-round pick, maybe he could kind of be like a steal of the draft. But then the Mets went and offered him $1 million, so that kind of isn't really a steal anymore. But, you know, he's a big kid. He's 6'3", 220. Fastball sits in the low 90s and is topped out as high as 96 right now. So there probably isn't much projection left in that. But it's, you know, that's a above average fastball right there. And he hides it well in his delivery. He kind of tucks his body in and during his leg lift, so it gets a lot of deception on that. And, you know, his secondary stuff is raw because, you know, he's right out of high school and everything. But he's developing his changeup and he's developing a knuckle curve. So he's someone for people to kind of keep an eye on as the years start going.
Yeah. All right.
And we would be remiss if we didn't mention Justin Dunn, who was the Mets' first round pick last year, who also can run up into the mid-90s and is also starting at St. Lucie and hopefully has gotten some tutelage from the Mets coaching staff in spring training and has tightened up those secondaries. So he's another guy to keep an eye on.
All right, let's go through some quick guys here. Greg, you mentioned Louis Guillaume as one of your guys.
Yeah, sure. So this is a guy who can play a professional shortstop, which is a valuable thing and in and of itself could carry him to potentially play in the majors. We saw Tovar play in the majors at some point. So, I mean, the Mets are not a second division team anymore, but I'm just saying Guillaume is a guy who can really pick it at short and can make contact. And if he could ever hit for a little bit of power, I think there would be a role there as a backup middle infielder potentially down the road. And also he has, you know, the reflexes of a cat, the speed of a mongoose, as we saw when he cut that bat out of the air. So I'm just saying this guy's got something.
That catch will live in infamy.
It was a good catch.
That's going to be what everybody's going to go to when he doesn't pan out.
Yeah, remember not. That guy?
But remember that guy? You know, he caught that bat in the spring training that year, you know. Steve, you had PJ Conlon on your list.
Yeah, he's a lot. He's kind of like almost like a left-handed Ricky Knapp. You know, his kind of. But, you know, his fastball is fringy, and he has a good changeup, but his curveball and his slider are kind of fringe to average at best. But he's just a guy. I feel like it's just hard to root against him. You know, he has one of those kinds of pitchers where, like I was saying, you know, he has no one great tool, but he has a lot of good, solid ones. And he's a several pitcher, and I'm hoping that, you know, he can, you know, he's going to be in Double A, and Double A is kind of the point where, you know, separates the men from the boys. So hopefully he's able to float and he doesn't sink, but...
All right, why don't you guys each pick two more of your guys to talk about? So, Greg, who do you want to highlight?
Okay, I want to highlight Nabil Krizmat. We will figure out how to pronounce that correctly at some point. But he's a guy who has a fantastic changeup and reportedly has touched 95. I think he's a little bit of a smaller dude. So if he's able to sit in the lower 90s And with that changeup, and he has a curveball, and if he's able to add a slider, like, this is a guy who has the command that is someone to get excited about. Is there anyone else I want to talk? I want to talk about Jeff McNeil, who is back from his double hernia, and he's going to be in Binghamton, and he still has 35 pounds of extra muscle, and he can still play the infield, and I'm excited about him, and he's going to have a good year.
All right, I'm going to go with my guy, Eudor Garcia. He was my guy last year, and then he got suspended for steroids, so that kind of sucked. But when he returned to the field, he played 55 games last year. He hit, you know, had a decent batting line. His slugging percentage was a little low, and I'm willing to give him a pass, and because, you know, he did start the 2016 season cold. His home run pace was about in line with what it was in 2016, so I don't think that his power is a steroid mirage. And honestly, I think if he had a little bit more playing time, you know, for a full season, he would have been in my top 25 list. Another guy I'm going to talk about is another third baseman, David Thompson. Who,
Steve's boy.
Yeah. He bombed in Brooklyn when he was first drafted. But, you know, he got a fresh start last year in Colombia, and he looked real good. He had to deal with a bunch of injuries that kind of took some of his steam away at the end. And then a promotion to St. Lucie with a little tougher competition. But he ended the season, you know, with a decent batting line and everything. And the biggest takeaway, I think, with him is that there were a lot of questions about his defense. And his defense was actually surprisingly good. His arm is so-so, but he's kind of rangy, and that kind of made up for the arm. And one last guy I guess I'll talk about is Tim Tebow.
No.
I'm going to go with Chris Vial. I've mentioned before, but I like him as a kind of sleeper guy. His numbers were kind of pedestrian in Kingsport, but there's a lot to like. His fastball sits in the mid-90s. It tops out at 97. And since he's 6'9", he kind of has that Chris Young thing going on where his fastball, you know, appears faster since there's less of a distance to travel. He struck out a ton of guys last year, but he also walked a ton of guys. And I think, you know, I'm no expert, obviously, but I think that the mechanical problems that he has can be kind of easily fixed. The biggest thing really is that because of his size, he kind of gets a little discombobulated. He doesn't, you know, repeat his delivery. Sometimes when he lifts his leg, it's high. Sometimes it's not very much of a lift. Sometimes when he plants his foot, you know, it points at home like it should be. Other times it's kind of pointing more crooked towards third. And that stuff really screws up his release point. So I think that if they kind of drill it into him to just kind of be more deliberate, he can kind of get the mechanics under control and get all that, all the walks under control.
All right, I'm going to throw something to you guys here. I did this with Chris for the both the offensive and defensive preview shows. So we're just going to go through the NL East for a second, and we're going to put the Mets system up against the other teams in the NL East. And you guys are going to tell me if you think the Mets system is on par or above or below the other teams. So let's start with the Washington Nationals. Is the Mets system better than the Nationals system? Greg?
Yes.
Steve?
Agreed, yes.
Braves? Is the Mets system better than the Braves? Steve?
No.
No.
Greg?
No.
No. That's not a surprise to anybody, I don't think. Phillies? Greg?
Shit, I don't remember. Yes.
The Mets system is better than the Phillies?
I'm saying yes.
Okay,
yes.
Steve, what do you say?
Yeah, I'm going to say that they are on par. I mean, both top prospects, J.P. Crawford and Amed Rosario, are kind of equals. And really, I don't know anything about the Phillies after that, so.
I feel like I'm wrong about that, but we can move on.
Okay. The Marlins.
Yeah, absolutely, yes.
Steve?
Yeah, I think maybe in a year or two, the Marlins will have a better system. They have a lot of talent kind of at the bottom. But for now, the Mets have a better system.
Okay, so rank them 1 through 5.
So then it would be Braves, Mets, Phillies, Nationals, Marlins.
Yeah, it's, I would maybe switch the Nats and the Phillies, but that sounds about right.
All right. All right, guys. Well, thank you for your minor league expertise. And are we all going to try and hit up a Brooklyn game this year?
Many Brooklyn games.
I'm down.
All right, let's make it happen.
Brian Wright here with the next edition of a Mets Top 5 list. Another opening day victory brings the total to 36, improving the franchise's all-time best winning percentage in this scenario. With much to choose from, here are the five greatest openers in club history. At number 5, it's 1975 against the Philadelphia Phillies. A familiar scene during the decade was the curtain-raising mound duel between Tom Seaver and Phil's ace Steve Carlton. Just as expected, the pair held opposing bats in check from the outset. Through 8, just a Dave Cash third-inning RBI double and a Dave Kingman fourth-inning home run turned out to be the only scoring generated against these Hall of Fame arms. They combined for 15 strikeouts and many frustrated hitters. But of course, there was only room for one winner, and in these days, no member of the bullpen was going to stand in either man's way. Seaver did his part in the top half of the ninth. Carlton had his chance to match, but the Mets beat him to the punch. Not wasting any time or outs, Felix Mian led off with a single. John Milner walked, and Joe Torre's base hit to left scored Mian and ensured another W in Seaver's column. From great pitching, we move on to great hitting at number 4 and 1988's debut in Montreal. The prevailing theory around baseball is, when compared to pitching, it takes longer for hitters to get in sync during the regular season. For the 88 Mets, it took about one inning. New York set what would be, at the time, a club record for most home runs in a game and the most by any team on opening day in a 10-6 victory over the Expos. Darryl Strawberry and Kevin McReynolds belted two homers apiece and combined to go 8-for-9 at the plate. Of all the home runs, Strawberry's second captured the most attention and was barely contained within the confines of Olympic Stadium as it struck the roof well beyond the right field fence. Kevin Elster in the fourth inning and Lenny Dykstra in the sixth provided the other two long balls, with Dykstra's blast coming with two runners on and the score tied at 4. Dwight Gooden was far from his dominating self. Fortunately, he didn't need to be. Even though he allowed 4 runs and 11 hits over 5 innings and 74 pitches, the victory was his. 8 years later, the Mets provided not just their greatest comeback victory on opening day, but one of the best rallies they've ever made in a regular season contest, and it's number 3 on the list. In soggy and chilly conditions, the Cardinals were spotted a 6-0 lead following the top of the 4th. New York began its charge soon after. A single by Rico Bronya and a home run by Todd Hundley, the first of what would be a club record 41 that year, cut the lead to 4. Bernard Gilkey stuck it to his former team with a homer of his own in the 6th. St. Louis tried to answer in the 7th, but Royce Clayton's attempt to score was foiled when Ray Ordonez, making his big league debut, somehow threw him out on his knees from left field. Ordonez then got his first major league hit during the bottom half of that frame, part of a string of 4 straight Mets singles that led to a 4-run inning and a 7-6 lead. That score would hold, as John Franco closed the door with a 1-2-3 ninth. The anticipation that normally comes with the first game of the season was ratcheted up several notches thanks to the return of an old friend in 1983, and the number 2 opening day in Mets history. In the wake of a contentious breakup and 5.5 years in Cincinnati, Tom Seaver returned to the team he made famous, and vice versa. The franchise was on the mound to make his record 15th opening day start, 11 of them with the Mets. Facing Steve Carlton, the Philadelphia Phillies, it was just like old times. No louder was the sellout crowd than on 2 occasions, when Seaver walked from the bullpen to the dugout prior to the start of the game, and then when he struck out Pete Rose to open the game. A beautiful, sunny Shea afternoon agreed with the delightful presence of number 41 back where he belonged, performing at the level his fans were accustomed to seeing. Just one tiny detail was missing. With Carlton matching zeros against his old rival, Seaver departed after 6 with a scoreless tie and thus was relegated to a no decision despite allowing just 3 hits and 1 walk. But the Mets pushed through for a pair of runs in the bottom of the 7th, the first on a Mike Howard single, and the second on a Brian Giles sacrifice fly. Doug Sisk's three effective innings would polish off the shutout. His victory, though, registered small typeface, in deference to the day's headline performer. As is customary, with each opening day comes high expectations. For 1985, optimism was overflowing. The Mets were coming off a 90-win season. They boasted a roster that included the previous two Rookie of the Year winners, and a first baseman that was a perennial All-Star. And now, through an off-season trade, they had baseball's top catcher. The validation of Gary Carter, acquired that winter from the Montreal Expos, was hardly questioned, but for some who might have wondered how it would affect team chemistry, those thoughts quickly dissolved once he ended game number one with his extra-inning walk-off homer against St. Louis. A storybook conclusion was preceded by a back-and-forth battle that would predate the pennant race to come in the following months. Card starter Joaquin Andujar was touched up for two hits, two walks, and a pair of first-inning runs. Dwight Gooden also had trouble warming up on the chilly Shea afternoon. He allowed runs in the second and third. New York countered by scoring in three consecutive innings. Doc would be knocked out during a two-run St. Louis seventh. But the Mets, specifically Doug Sisk, had a chance to close the door in the ninth, and failed. A single, hit by pitch, and a walk loaded the bases. Jack Clark, who took Gooden deep earlier, also drew a free pass. 5-5. All that did, though, was set the stage for the newest Met to provide 10th-inning heroics against a former Met. Neil Allen hung a curveball. Gary Carter didn't miss. The drive to left field eluded the glove of Lonnie Smith as it snuck over the fence. This was more than just a 6-5 victory and the greatest opening day in New York's 56 seasons. It confirmed the winning ways were here to stay, and the best days were soon to come. That closes our list on the openers. Once more, I'm Brian Wright.
Hello, this is Aaron York for Amazing Avenue Audio, and I'm not sure what my weekly segment is going to be based on this year, but I do know what I'm talking about this week, and that's the changes that the Mets have made to their uniforms in 2017, which is this year. There will be changes from 2016 to 2017, and most of those are subtle, but there is one large change, and that is, at least so far, the elimination of the Running Mr. Met logo from the spring training jersey and presumably from the alternate blue jersey, which has been very similar to the spring training jersey in recent years. The Mets used to wear the Mr. Met running logo on their spring training and batting practice caps, as well as the left sleeve of their alternate and spring training uniforms. So far, that Running Mr. Met on the hat has been replaced by the orange and Y logo outlined in white like it was on their alternate hats last year. Now that's part of the spring training / batting practice cap as well, with the orange brim. And now that the orange brim and the NY with the white outline is on that batting practice cap, that means that the alternate cap that goes with the blue uniforms, they've taken the orange brim out of that, so it's going to look a lot more like the standard blue cap with the orange logo. The only difference is that the alternate version will have that white outline along the NY, so no more orange brims. During the game, you'll still see them on the batting practice cap. I believe Terry Collins was wearing it in one of his press conferences. So that's going to be a little change to the Mets hats. And as for the uniform, the Running Mr. Met on the sleeve has been replaced by the traditional circular Mets logo with the skyline and the bridge and the script Mets. And that's a bit of a shame because we already see that on the regular home and road uniforms. Why the team saw the need to put it on the alternate, which had the awesome Mr. Met logo on it last year, is a mystery to me for now. But I'll update our listeners soon, or if we're able to find any information on that. Right now, it's a little bit of a disappointment, although I am glad that they got rid of the orange brim on the alternate hat. I'm just not a huge fan of two-toned hats with a brim the different color as the top of the hat, but a lot of people like that, and at least if you do like that style, it's still available in the batting practice cap. But as for hats with Mr. Met running on them, they're going to be harder to come by. The good news is that overall, the Mets still have a really great look. They have the pinstriped home uniforms, the great gray road uniforms with the New York script across, and then you have the alternate blue versions of each uniform, and you still have the alternate road hats with the gray NY. Not a huge fan of that, even though I like the gray slash silver lettering on the road alternates. I don't love the fact that it extends to the hat, but you could see the continuity that they're trying to achieve there. So, biggest change for Mets uniforms in 2017 is no Mr. Met on batting practice cap, no Mr. Met on alternative sleeve, and hopefully they bring him back at some point in the future, because I think we all could use more Mr. Met in our lives. This is Aaron York for Mazen Avenue Audio.
So now we welcome to the show Mazen Avenue alumnus and author of a book about the 99 and 2000 Mets, Matthew Callen. If you have been reading the site over the years, you've read plenty of his stuff, whether it be recaps, just sort of editorial type things of the day, whatever was going on with the Mets at the time, and especially the great long piece about the Grand Slam single. So, Matthew, thanks for coming on and chatting about your new book.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. I'm really excited to talk about it and to be on the show.
So I think people who have been following and are familiar with your work are aware that this book has been in the works and excited to maybe be able to get their hands on it. You know, what is it, I guess, for people who may not be as familiar, what is it that drew you to this era of the team as sort of something that, you know, I think you are really like the guy for that time of the Mets when it comes to, you know, just looking back at it and focusing on it?
I think probably, first of all, from just a personal standpoint, it's the team that really like drew me back into baseball in general. Like I really, this is probably a similar arc to a lot of people, but you know, I liked baseball a lot as a kid. I sort of drifted away from it as a teenager and you know, I guess through college years. And that 99 team was probably the first time that the first like stirrings of like, oh, you liked baseball, maybe you should like it again, you know? And, so I almost always felt like it was, you know, personally felt like it was like, oh, this is the team that brought me back to baseball. There's probably something special there, you know? And so I think as more time passed and, the Mets progressed through sort of a, you would say probably after the 2000 season, you know, there were some pretty slender seasons there. You know, those years almost looked more and more fantastic, you know, when compared to sort of the Art Howe era. So I think it was probably sort of, you know, personal and then, you know, sort of in a sort of an immediate nostalgia. But I think the more that I did delve into it, I find those years very fascinating because of what had happened to the Mets as a team in a city where, you know, the Yankees were obviously the predominant team of that era in baseball in general and definitely in the city. And there were serious concerns, I think, that the Mets would just kind of disappear. Like they just wouldn't be part of, you know, the discussion, which, you know, in sports in the city. And I think they sort of, even though they didn't win a championship in those years, obviously, I think in particular, just the craziness of 1999 sort of sort of like re-energize their, you know, not to get too corpo speak, but sort of like re-energize their brand. Because yeah. The way that they went about that season was at the same time very much of that era, but also extremely Mets-like, just sort of the craziness of it. And I'm sure any Mets fan can point to a million different things that happened that year that make absolutely no sense at all, or wouldn't make any sense at all for another team, but which are very much of a piece with like the sort of miraculous slash insane history of the team. So yeah. That's sort of a long-winded reason why I find those teams very fascinating, but that's probably as much as I can possibly nutshell it.
It's when you look at it now, I think with a little bit of separation time-wise, what's the overall impression I think that you have of Bobby Valentine at this point in time? Because I think he was a guy who, when he was manager, he was mostly loved by fans, which is kind of rare for a manager. At least that's how it always felt to me. But some time has gone by. There were a couple points over the years since then that the Mets were looking for a new manager. You had some Mets fans who wanted to see him brought back. He hasn't really done a ton of managing in Major League Baseball since then, and those tenures have been brief. But looking back at it, obviously, coming back to the dugout in disguise is the Bobby Valentine moment of these years.
Yeah.
But, what do you look and see in terms of him as a manager?
I think he was probably a better manager than people tend to give him credit for. From a pure sort of like tactician's type standpoint, just watching what he would do, he was willing to do, he was more than willing to do more unconventional things, and he was, he was not afraid to fail, or I don't know, maybe not afraid to fail is a bad word, but not afraid to experiment in a way that I think a lot of managers are reluctant to do. But I think also from a personality standpoint, I think it would be extremely difficult to have a manager like that nowadays, because he was very much the focus of the team. And sometimes he did that to take pressure off of his team, and sometimes he did that because that was just his personality. He had a need to be the center of attention. He would pick fights with players all the time, and sometimes it was to motivate them, and sometimes it just seemed to be completely pointless. I'm sure Mets fans of a certain age remember him clashing a lot with Todd Hundley, and that seems very mysterious to me. Just looking back on it, what little we do know about it, obviously there's always been rumors that Todd Hundley might have had a drinking problem, or he there's certainly rumors that he was he all of a sudden hit all those home runs not just by eating Wheaties. So there's extenuating factors there, but also it seemed like he just felt the need to like pick fights with people. He's just kind of a cantankerous personality in that respect. I can't imagine that somebody like that, even though he did manage the Red Sox a couple of years ago, but obviously unsuccessfully, I just feel like that type of manager, he seems closer to me in retrospect to the Earl Weaver type manager than he does to most modern managers, who are either sort of, very basic functionaries, or if they do have a personality, it's sort of in the other direction. It's a Joe Maddon type, where it's like he's like a cheerleader, or he's like a fun guy to be around. And Bobby Valentine never never struck me as necessarily being a fun guy to be around. I do think, I think that he's probably a better manager than we remember him being, or that especially other people, maybe say fans of other teams who couldn't stand him might remember. But it's overshadowed by the fact that he had such a strong personality, and often in a negative way, that I feel like you just couldn't have that kind of manager nowadays.
That kind of guy, the person who, if he's on your team, you love him and everybody else hates him. It's a fun type of thing to experience as a fan. You know, I think early Jose Reyes was sort of a similar thing, that he was demonstrative and he liked to celebrate and do handshakes and dance and all that stuff. And it would piss off every other fan base. And, you know, we got to love it and enjoy it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I like that kind of thing, just because getting under the skin of the other side is kind of fun.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, he was, there was a, I mean, it, this goes back to before the time that Bobby Valentine was managing the Mets, but he used to, I mean, his nickname was Top Step, because he was always at the top step of the dugout back when that was a place that was a lot closer. I mean, like, if you think of the way that stadiums used to be designed, like, you had to make more of an effort to kind of do that. Kind of, you know, if you think back to the old sort of like cookie cutter concrete bowl stadiums, they're,
right,
the dugouts weren't designed in such a way that they were encouraging players and managers and coaches to like all come up to that top rail and watch the game. Like, they weren't supposed to do that. And he did that. And he did it. The biggest reason why he did it was so he could get on the other team. Like, he could yell at the umps, or he could yell at people of the other team and psych them out. Like, Al Leiter shared a story. I forget the exact source, but it's definitely somewhere in my book, where Al Leiter came to the Mets, and he was Al Leiter grew up in New Jersey. He grew up a Mets fan and was very excited to join the Mets, but he also was reticent to play for a guy who used to scream at him. Like, do you remember Al Leiter used to pitch for the Marlins? And he remembered, like, literally the year before, Leiter pitching for the Marlins, Bobby Valentine managing the Mets. Like, the year before he joined the Mets, he remembers Bobby Valentine yelling at him and, like, trying to psych him out and telling him he wasn't going to make it out of the fifth inning and all this other stuff. And this ambivalence of, like, oh, now I got to play for this guy. like he wasn't sure if he could even do it, because it was the kind of abuse that Bobby Valentine would heap onto other players for, you know, not entirely sincerely, I don't think. Like, did he actually think Al Leiter was a terrible pitcher? Of course not, because Al Leiter wasn't a terrible pitcher at that point in his career. But he knew that Al Leiter, being an excitable guy, that he could get under his skin. And often he did to other players. And obviously, that's one of many reasons why other teams couldn't stand him.
Yeah, yeah, it's... It was a fascinating time, I think, for this team. And it, like all of the eras, however brief they may have been, that the Mets have actually been good, you know, they've been pretty rare over the years. We haven't been spoiled. Maybe we're on this course now, I hope, but we haven't been spoiled with a team that can contend at least for a playoff spot year in and year out over the course of a decade. So, you know, for me, the 99 and 2000 seasons were memorable, and I was into it, you know, similar to what you were saying about sort of that, like, the season that really hooks you and gets you back in. For me, if I drifted at all, it was during maybe college, 2003, 4, 5 weren't exactly, like, the best times for the Mets.
Yeah.
So 2006 was similar, and then, you know, I keep trying to remind myself that we're, you know, we're in one of those right now, and not to take it for granted.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's very rare I think it's probably rare for a lot of, you know, more teams than not. I think it's rare.
Right. Yeah. The Yankees and Braves doing the, you know, winning the division, or at least making the playoffs for the better part of 10, 15 years. That is not normal.
Yeah. I also feel like it's very easy to, I think if all of a sudden you become one of those teams that makes it every year, it's very easy to become complacent. Like, you think about, just think about the Giants. Like, the Giants were one of those teams that were in the wilderness, like, forever, you know, and couldn't get over the hump. And they would have some good years, but never quite make it. And now they've won, like, you know, they win 3 World Series in the span of 5 years, which is like an amazing run. But I feel like, you sort of like survey the sort of fan base, and this is obviously something that's not quite quantifiable, but I feel like you look at a fan base that sort of goes from being luckless to, you know, expecting good things to happen all the time, and you know, you can very, I feel like you can very quickly go from like one extreme to the other, you know. So I hope, you know, knock on wood, if this is sort of like a good era that we're in the middle of, that people sort of, you know, appreciate it.
Yeah. So the book, I don't know if I said the title up top, but the name is Yells for Ourselves. I just wanted to get into a little bit of it, you know, the title, you know, where is that from, or, you know, what does it mean? And then sort of the overview of it, you know, obviously it's about these two seasons, I should say, of the team.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but just sort of stylistically, I think, you know, and there's a sample available on the site where you can pre-order the book, also at yellsforourselves.com. So yeah, I guess where's the title from, and then, you know, what would be your overview of what the book is and how the whole process works at this point?
Well, the title comes from, it was one of the first articles ever written about the Mets back in 1962 by Roger Angel, who's the, you know, the legendary sports writer for the New Yorker, and you know, still with us and still writing, you know, great baseball writing to this day. But he wrote one of the very first, if not the first, studies of Mets fans early in the 1962 season, because, you know, he went up to the Polo Grounds where the Mets were playing back then and sort of was observing the folk ways of Mets fans who were already, this, I believe we wrote the article, was still relatively early in that season. It was already evident that the 1962 Mets were historically bad. But he was noticing that these people coming to these games were just going crazy for them anyway. And they were already chanting, "Let's go Mets." Like, that's a thing that started that early. And he just wanted to know why. Like, why would people go cheer a team that was so bad? And the conclusion that he came to is that they, you know, obviously the fan base back then was all sort of still brokenhearted former Dodgers and Giants fans. But he sort of concluded that the fan base of that time, that's the Mets of that era, exhibited something that couldn't be provided by the Yankees, who, you know, remember back in the early 60s, that would have still been the Yankees of Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle, you know, just the world-beating dynastic Yankees. It was still that team. But the Mets provided some other kind of thing for the people who cheered for them. And the thing that he said was that the cheers for, and what I'm sort of remembering from memory now, but I believe he said that the cheers for the Mets of that era, the people actually at the Polo Grounds, were yells for ourselves.
Right, yeah.
Because there was more of, I believe he said, there was more of the Mets than the Yankees in all of us. So I took that as the title, basically because, you know, unfortunately you cannot write about the Mets of that era without writing about the Yankees as well, because a lot of the things that they did were an effort to reinsert themselves into sort of the discussion of sports of that time. I mean, the first thing I kind of do in the book is sort of set the scene, really, and this is part of the sample that you mentioned. If you go to yellsforourselves.com or inkshares.com, where the book is up for pre-order, the sample that I have up is sort of the prologue of the book, and it has basically all of sort of the background information leading up to, you know, what you basically, like, here's what you need to know before you kind of dive headfirst into 1999. And, you know, the biggest thing that happened in the 1990s was that obviously the Yankees became a juggernaut, but also the Mets just kind of fell apart. And what had often happened in the history of just sort of New York in terms of baseball was that either the Mets would be good and the other team would be bad, or vice versa. And then what was happening in the 1990s was that the Mets, you know, well into the early 90s, the New York was could be considered very much a Mets town. Then the Mets had this historically bad season in 1993 that is just other than the fact that they lost a lot of games, they were just an awful, awful team, like from a moral standpoint, which it's like a show in itself is how bad this team was. And the Yankees were able to take advantage of that. People very quickly sort of abandoned the Mets and became Yankees fans. And obviously at the same time, the city itself was changing. It was becoming, you know, obviously 1993, Rudy Giuliani becomes mayor. The city changes a lot over the course of his administration. And the more I sort of looked into the sort of the history of the Mets of that era, the more I was seeing like all these parallels between what was happening in New York City itself and what was sort of the landscape of baseball, of sort of the Mets being pushed to the margins and the Yankees being the dominant, the dominant sports force in the city again. So the book basically, other than being it's of course a chronicle of those years from a Mets standpoint, but it's also sort of studying that in the context of what was happening sort of in the city, you know, politically, culturally. You know, I would say it's probably, you know, 70-30 baseball to non-baseball content. But I think that it's almost impossible to talk about, just as it's basically impossible to talk about the Mets without talking about the Yankees at that time, it's also impossible to talk about either team without talking about what was happening in the city, because it was, you know, all the changes that were happening were sort of part and parcel with what was happening in sports. And especially since, you know, the mayor of the era sort of almost like wedded himself to the success of the Yankees. It was sort of like those two things were wedded to each other. It was, you know, the fact that the Yankees were a dominant team again was almost entirely coincidental to the fact that New York was having a renaissance of sorts. But those two things were constantly sort of pointed to at the same time. Like there were efforts made to sort of make those two things, you know, reliant on one another, I guess, in the public consciousness. So again, it's very hard to talk about one without the other.
Yeah, no, that certainly makes sense. So in terms of the pre-order and everything, people can go to Inkshares if they're not familiar. Is there anything else that they need to know in terms of doing that, or, you know, what the process is, or?
Not really. It's just Inkshares, if people aren't familiar with it. It's almost like a Kickstarter for books. And basically, you know, you put a book up there and people can pre-order it. If it gets enough pre-orders, then Inkshares itself will publish it. So it's sort of like, you know, again, like Kickstarter, where you have a goal and you're trying to hit it. That's essentially it. And, you know, people can order it for as little as $10. Ebook version is $10. I believe the paperback version is $20. Because it's going to be a rather large book if it actually becomes a book. And, you know, paper costs money, unfortunately. So but you know, if you just want to go for the ebook version, you know, that still counts as a pre-order and every single one helps. And you know, if we get enough pre-orders, it'll be an actual book that everybody can, you know, order on Amazon or, you know, your checkout at your local bookshop.
Yeah, well, I am certainly rooting for that and wish you luck with everything in terms of the publishing end. I'm definitely looking forward to getting my hands on it and reading the entire thing. You know, just going back over the years, I think when I had first started doing Amazing Avenue things, you had been doing them for a little while, and it was always, and really still to this day, you know, sometimes with recaps and that kind of thing, I could get into a spot where, like, man, I wish I could put those words together or sequence things like he did. So I think that legacy on the site, I think, is very strong, and I've always appreciated it. And a very long book about a team that is fun to remember is something that I'm definitely looking forward to.
Oh, well, thank you. And I hope it becomes a book as well. And, you know, Amazing Avenue was very good to me in terms of just letting me write about 1999 and 2000 related stuff all the time. So, I mean, this book absolutely would not exist without Amazing Avenue, you know, for a bunch of different reasons. So if it actually does become a book, it's, you know, by which I mean if it actually becomes published, you know, I definitely owe a huge debt to Amazing Avenue, and you know, hopefully we can make it happen.
Yeah. All right, so one more time before we wrap up, Matthew Callen, the book is Yells for Ourselves. You can find it at yellsforourselves.com, Inkshares, you can find it there, and we will definitely have links to both of those in the notes of the podcast when it goes up on the site. So there you have it. Matt, thanks again for coming on.
Thanks again for having me.
Hey everyone, it's Kate with your first official week one in season Panic City Meter. And I don't have a whole lot of good news for you, which is a great way to start off a season, let me tell you. So, well, I guess we have some good news. The Mets won opening day. They beat the Braves 6-0. Lucas Duda had a bases-clearing double off a lefty, which is always nice to see, especially considering the back stuff. And, you know, everyone fit in. Wilmer Flores steals bases now or something. I'm sure that's going to end terribly, but it was kind of fun for now. And Syndergaard looked really good. Syndergaard is really good. Let's just get that out of the way first. Syndergaard also has a blister on his finger, so his second start has already been pushed back, and Robert Gisellman was moved up to slot in. They say it's nothing. It's probably nothing. Blisters are usually nothing until they are something, which also happens. So, you know, I guess we'll see how that one takes. There is much worse news, though. So we have Steven Matz ended up on the DL with a flexor tendon strain. They don't know how long that's going to be out. He's going to be out. They say it's minor, you know, no significant inflammation. Who knows? And Seth Lugo has a partially torn UCL, which is, I suppose, better news than fully torn, because they say he's not going to get Tommy John yet. He's just going to rest for a few weeks and then take it from there. We'll see. We have all heard this story before, and sometimes it ends well. It usually doesn't. And because we are all pessimistic Mets fans, I'm just going to assume it won't end well. And suddenly, your legendary Mets pitching depth is number 6 starter, Rafael Montero, which is a scary place to be on game 2. And, you know, Syndergaard is probably fine. You still have a great starting 5, but if Zach Wheeler can't actually pitch, or Matt Harvey gets hurt, or Syndergaard's blister turns into a thing, it's getting dicey really early, really quickly. I personally have said all offseason that they needed to have brought in some 200-inning workhorse just to guarantee, because you have so many fragile pitchers. Like, all pitchers are fragile. all of your Mets pitchers are coming off relatively major surgery. Yet we don't have that, so I guess I'll talk to you when Adam Wilk is making starts in June. I don't know. It could all work out. Maybe it's be the year that Mets injuries are just a blip on the radar, but this is also the Mets, so it probably won't be. I'm recording this Wednesday morning. You probably won't hear this until Thursday, Friday maybe, so pretend I talked lovingly about the next 2-1 games that they won. I'm sure they're going to blow out the Braves. But hopefully I'll have better news for you next week.
Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for listening. This was a fun show, and hopefully we're going to bring you lots more fun shows throughout the season. As always, go to AmazingAvenue.com to read more from the folks you heard today. You can find all of our work there, and we really killed it this first week. Not trying to brag or anything, but there was some great, great, great opening week coverage, and look forward to more of that throughout the season. You can also find Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, at Amazing Avenue. You can email the show, podcast@AmazingAvenueAudio.com. We really enjoy your emails. We did get an email this week we didn't get to, but there was enough going on this week. I think it's an evergreen question. We'll get to it next week. I promise. In addition, if you would like to download the show, you can do so from iTunes, from Stitcher, from your podcatcher of choice, or directly from blogtalkradio.com. If you're using iTunes, please do rate, review, and subscribe. It does help the show considerably. Thank you in advance for doing that. And as always, you can follow all of us on Twitter. I'm at Brian Needs a Nap. Chris is at Chris McShane. Aaron is at Aaron P. York. Gotta get used to that new Twitter handle. Still want to say APY5000. Steve Sipa is at Steve Sipa. Greg Karam is at Greg Karam. Kate Feldman is at Kate E. Feldman. Congratulations to Kate being the new editor-in-chief of BP Mets this season. Congrats, Kate. And is that everybody? Oh, and Brian Wright. Almost forgot. He's the new guy. I'm going to forget him a few times. Brian Wright is at Brian Wright 86. So by this time next week, we'll know if Thor's blister is a big deal. Probably isn't. We'll know how Matt Harvey and Zach Wheeler look. Hopefully very good. And we'll be well on the way to a pennant winning season. Or so I hope. So until next time, let's go Mets. How are you, Lucas?
I'm okay. Is it? I have no feel on how my audio is. So show it.
I had to hang up on it.